derivative expansion, so the weak coupling expansion, for the interacting scalar field with a lambda 5^4 interaction. So an interaction, a contact interaction between two bosons, two quanta of the field. And in fact, what I have been doing yesterday, you could have done it, or I think, in fact, that you already started to do it, using the rules of canonical quantization. Because the basic idea is to expand around the free field, and you use the Vick theorem. And the Vick theorem, you have seen that you can derive it in canonical quantization. You can derive it using the functional integration formalism, the path integral formalism. But once you have the Vick theorem, it's just you turn the crank, and you end up with basically the sum of the Feynman diagrams. Okay. So what I want to show today is that, in fact, path integral method, or rather functional integral method, because now I'm dealing with integration about functions, so I will speak about functional integrals rather than path integrals. In general, I will show you that the path, the functional integral methods give you a way to compute and to manipulate correlation functions of the so green function of the quantum theory in a fast way, in a very global way. So you can construct rules which allow you not to compute each diagram, diagram by diagram, but to manipulate a lot of diagrams at the same time and to end up quickly to a result. And only at the end, you have, of course, to compute the Feynman diagrams. Okay. So that's what I want to do today. And but before that, I want to warn you that perhaps you didn't pay attention. I think some pay attention. But all what I did yesterday was wrongly, well, strongly ill-defined for the following reason. Remember that last time we always had sometimes this diagram in the perturbative expansion. Not always, but most of the diagram we constructed yesterday had this part. And this part represents just the expectation value, well, let us write it in the real time, part of the time ordered product of two field operator at the same point. And I explained before that this was infinite, because this is given by the in Fourier transform by d4k over 2π^4, 1/k². This is the Fourier transform of the propagator, but the propagator is infinite. Okay, there is a factor I here, but up to a factor I, okay? And this integral is what is called ultraviolet divergence. Okay. So everywhere in what I was computing, there are infinite factors. And that's the first one of the aspects of renormalization theory. So in fact, so you have two ways to cure this problem. So at the moment, I will close by high and do everything as if this was finite. So I will be mostly doing combinatorics and manipulating integrals without caring whether these integrals are finite or infinite, whether I can make sense of them or not. Okay? But you can cure that problem, or at least be reassured in two ways. First, you can change a little bit the theory so that this becomes finite. And for instance, imagine that you assume that the momenta are always smaller than some large momenta. Then this integral becomes finite, and everything is fine. And this amounts to change the behavior of the theory, of the free field theory, at high energy. And that's possible in many, many ways. For instance, we can just put the theory replace the continuum space-time by a lattice, I did at the beginning. And if you have a lattice, you have a minimal distance, the smallest distance. Therefore, you have the largest momenta, and that's it. So that's the first cure, is to change the theory. Change at short distances. Okay. The second way is to change slightly the definition of the propagator of this object. So, because this is a phi 4, this is a phi square operator, and it's one way is to change the definition of operators like phi squared or phi to the 4, etc. Okay. Slightly, so that the theory still makes sense. And I will discuss that next week. But that's another way to consider renormalization, is to change the definition of operator, which are products of the elementary operator, the field operator, at the same point. And that's also something which makes sense in the framework of quantum field theory. Okay. So now, let us forget about the fact that this is infinite. And let us come back to what I will call generating functionals and functional calculus for dealing, for managing with perturbation theory. Okay. So remember that we were interested in computing what is called the Green function, the functions of the theory. And the Green functions were basically in at real time given by products of time order product of field operator, and you were interested in those matrix elements in real time. Okay. And we have seen that these objects are given by, in fact, the functional integral exponential I s of phi, phi of z1, phi of zn. And you have to divide, normalize by this functional integral for a simple reason. Okay. Why do you have to divide by this normalization factor? That's because you don't know exactly which kind of measure you must use in the functional integral. I've not discussed that point. But what you want, of course, is that the scalar product of the ground state of the vacuum of the theory with itself is 1. Okay. So that's the normalization factor. And if you choose this normalization factor to divide this integral, this ensures that this is satisfied. You see? And one last remark. This vacuum state is, of course, the vacuum of the interacting theory, not the vacuum of the free field, but the vacuum of the full theory given by this action, whatever it is. Okay. So, okay. So, and we have seen that when you compute this, you end up with many, many Feynman diagrams. And what I did yesterday was, in fact, not to compute this object, but just to compute either this integral, and these integrals give you the sum over vacuum diagrams, what is called vacuum diagrams, like this one, this one, etc. Okay, and this gives both diagrams connecting those external points, but it contains also the vacuum diagrams. Okay? And we would like to get rid of the vacuum diagrams because the vacuum diagrams contribute to the vacuum energy, the energy of the vacuum, and the energy of the vacuum is not present in such expectation value, in such Green function, because it's just a normalization of the energy of the vacuum, and it doesn't play any role in the physics. It's just a normalization. What counts is the difference of energy between the ground state and the excited states. Okay, so those vacuum diagrams disappear from this quantity. Nevertheless, they are here. Okay. So in order to, and I will call this, let me call this the Green function g of z1, zn. Okay. And the Green function with n points, so I will put an n here. Okay. And I remind you that I'm considering the 5-4 series, namely the action is simply, in this case, integral d4x minus 1/2 of d mu phi minus m squared over 2 phi squared. Okay? So, you can construct an object which will contain all those Green functions in the following way. Let me consider the functional. I write what it is. It's a functional integral over function. And I had a source term. I will explain what it is. And remember, there is always an h bar, and the h bar was a way that. Minus g over 5 to the 4. Of course, I'm considering the interacting theory, so I have this term. Okay. So now, let us write, add to this a source term. And what does this mean? G phi means just integral over the space-time of g of x, phi of x. Okay. So phi is a random variables you are integrating out. It's the field you are integrating. But g here is a classical source. So it's a classical source term. It's called a classical source term. Then it's a function. It's a regular function. OK? With some regularity properties. I take a smooth function. And so instead of computing this functional integral, I compute this. And I end up with a complicated result, which is a functional of the source. It's a function of a function over space-time, which is a function g. OK? So this is a functional. And you see that if you expand this in powers of g of x, what you get for a term of order gx are just the Green function, provided that you have this, if you divide by this. So what is this? This is just this term. It's just the functional when the source term vanishes. Okay? And when the source term doesn't vanish, this term contains these terms. See? Pardon?
You said when what?
When g is different from 0, expand this, you see. Expand this, and you see that z of g is just sum. Expand the exponential. And I can write this as 1 over k, I over h bar to the power k, Planck constant. And then integral dx1 dxk of d phi e I over h bar s of phi of xk. Okay, I've just expanded the exponential. And of course, I have expanded the exponential, and I have made an assumption which is not at all Benning, which is to interchange the functional integral and the sum. You see, because if I expand the exponential, the sum is inside the functional integral, and I have exchanged the sum and the functional integral. And that's something which is not at all trivial mathematically. And in fact, there are a lot of problems hidden in this interchange of a sum and of a functional integral. But I won't discuss that. Okay? So now, there is a compact way to write this, which is to use what is called functional derivative. Okay. So I will define the functional derivative in the following way. I will say that if in one expression, I forgot, of course, to write the g of x. So this is the term which is in front of g of x1, g of xk. Okay, of course, completely forgot. Okay. So I will define the functional derivative in the following sense. I will say that I have some expression which depend on a function g. And I will define the functional derivative with respect to the function g taken at the point x simply as the term containing the g of x in this integral here. You see? Yes?
Oh. Okay, so what's that fx1, fx2?
Pardon? Okay. So, each time that I have, here I have an integral over x1 times gx1, an integral over x2 gx2, etc. And so I will define this term, in fact, as the term of order k in the expansion of this functional in term of g. You see? And therefore, I will take it as a definition. I will define. Now, let me consider the functional derivative with respect to g of x1, g of xk, etc. So I have to obtain k functional derivative of this expression. What do I do here? And let me write rather this as with a y1 yk, because these x are dummy variables, and I'm integrating over them. But I want to take the functional derivative with respect to g at a fixed point. So the y are not dummy variables, while the x are dummy variables. Okay. What do I get? I take a first functional derivative with respect to y1. So I'm looking where is there a g of y1 somewhere in this expression. Well, every time that x1 may be equal to g to y1, but x2 may be equal to y1 sometimes in this integral. So I have k term which contributes. Okay. So by doing the first functional derivative, I kill 1g. There is a factor k because I have k. So I'm killing 1k in this factorial, and I'm ending up with k minus 1g. You see?
Etc.
Okay.
In your definition for yes. The functional derivative,
yes.
You would probably want to say that it's a term containing jx in the integral, but without that j. Right?
Yes, without.
But dropping
yes,
that
yes.
j.
Yes, dropping, right? Of course. Dropping the g, and, of course, and the integral.
Right.
For them, integrating, and I'm picking only the term contains g of x for this specific x. Okay? So, now, let us do that. What I end up is that the sum of all possible terms when I am removed, g of y1, g of, I'm sorry, g, this is g of yk, and let us compute this when g equals 0. So once I have taken k derivative, so once I have removed kg, I set g equal to 0 so that all the terms which have more sources than the number of sources I'm interested, because here I can have k, but I can have a larger number of k. Okay? What I'm ending up with simply I over h bar to the power k if I ei over h bar actually 5 times phi of y1 phi of yk. So take this as a definition of the functional derivatives, but it's important to see the logic of it. Okay? But you can take it as a definition of the functional derivative. Okay?
How about the sum?
Yes.
The sum.
Pardon?
The sum. There is no sum.
There is no sum. Not anymore. Because I have, well, I could have, here is, I should have taken not k, but let us say m point, okay? Because here k is a dummy variable, I'm summing, and here I am taking the functional derivative with respect to a fixed number of variables. So when I am doing that and taking n functional derivative and setting g equal to 0, I am only acting on the term where k is equal to m. And in this term, I am only picking up the term where one of the g here is g of y1, one of the term here is g of y2, etc. Just to one of the term where g of x is equal to g of ym. So that's why I get phi of y1, etc., up to phi of ym.
Why don't we ask what the why do we have m instead of k? I mean, if m is different from k, then we wouldn't expect that factorial out front to perfectly cancel.
No, because, see, the term in this sum with k less than m cancel. Because after some time, you have no source to divide. So it's like if you take compute the second derivative of a function, the first derivative is the period.
Yeah.
Exactly the same. Okay, so take this as a definition of the functional integral. But you see, this definition, in this definition, it's not important what is this term here. So it applies to any function z which can be expanded as an integral over some products of g times something depending on the position of the point. See? Okay. So once we have done that, we can write. So remember this expression. You see that this expression can be written very simply as means that the green function of the interacting theory is simply product from, here I have n points, not k points, neither n point, but n point. So I have the product from a equal 1 n of I over h bar a functional derivative with respect to g at the point za, the product of n functional derivative, acting on this functional z of g, I take g equals 0, and I divide by this. Therefore, I divide by c of g equals 0. Okay, and I have a very compact expression of the green function of the inductive theorem. Okay. So now, starting from now, in fact, I will do something which will perhaps confuse you. But here there are a lot of I factor, and I don't like I factor because I am mostly doing statistical mechanics. Yes?
Should I over h bar be h bar over I to cancel the I over h bar in the expression?
Oh, yes, yes, I'm sorry. So everything this is done at real time, and up to now, in order to not be confused with the I factor and the phases, I will define the same functional generating function at Euclidean time. So at Euclidean time, that's the same game, thinking. I define Z of Z as exponential, as a functional integral of exponential minus 1 over h bar Euclidean action for phi, and I have to these terms minus g of phi, with g of phi the same definition. Okay? And with this definition, the Euclidean ring function gn of z1 zn, I put an e indicated this integral function. It is now the expectation value of phi of z1, phi of zn. I don't need to indicate whether there is a time ordering or not, because there is no time ordering. And this is given exactly by the same formula, except that the factor I has disappeared. There is a minus times a minus, so this is the product A of h bar delta over delta g of ZA z of g. So this is the formula. This is the definition of the generating functional in real time. There is I g phi. This is the definition of the functional generating for green function in Euclidean time, and there is a minus times minus g phi, so there's an exponential of g phi. And this is the relation between the green function in Euclidean time and the generating function. Okay. But once you have applied, you can start from that, make a big rotation, and end up here. You can compute the green function using the Euclidean generating function. And once you have done that, you do the big rotation, the inverse rotation, and go back and recover those green functions. Yes?
Should this be evaluated at j equals 0 and then divided by z of j equals
0? Oh, yes, yes. That's right. Sorry. I spoke too. I assumed that I had already written that. Yeah, yeah. So this is simply the I factor has disappeared. Okay? Okay. So now, remember that this functional integral, this generating function, or this generating function, contains all the Feynman diagrams of the theory, in some sense. It's a very, very compact way to write. So this z of g means simply the sum over all Feynman diagrams. It's a very, very compact way to write the sum over all the Feynman diagrams of the theory. Okay? And now I will define slightly different generating function. I will define a function W of G, which is simply the logarithm of Z of G. Okay? So it's another generating function. Yes?
How is it that we say that the Green's function contains all the Feynman diagrams, but it's ZJ that has the information and not G?
Z of G contains all the Feynman diagrams with an arbitrary number of epsilon legs. It contains the vacuum diagram.
Right.
It contains the Feynman diagrams of the two-point function. It contains the Feynman diagram of the four-point function. Everything.
Oh, and we're using this, in effect, this derivative to extract them.
Yeah, to extract them, you have to take the functional derivative in order to just keep the term here with the correct number of phi. You are interested. See? Yes? Okay. So now, you can now consider what is this function W of G. And in order to be a little bit more careful, I will, so there is a factor 1 over H here, remember? So I will multiply this by H, so that in some sense this resembles to the action. Okay? So I define this, another generating function. And I'm asking, what is this generating function? And it turns out that this generating function, I will give you an example later, contains the sum of all the connected diagrams. Okay? Remember that we had diagrams, for instance, where we are computing the two point function. We had we have of course it start by the propagator, and then we had, oh, that's a bad example, but it contains diagram like that. But assume that we are interested in the four-point function. The four-point function contains diagram like that, products of two propagators. That's a contribution from the Vic theorem, so it's a term which comes from the free theory. And then you may have term like that, which comes from the interacting theory, because you have a vertex which comes from a 5-4 theory. This is connected. This is disconnected. Okay? Disconnected because you have two parts which are non-joint. That's the definition of, so you have an intuitive definition, you see. You immediately recognize what if a Feynman diagram is connected or disconnected. And it turns out that this W of G, this new functional, contains all the connected diagrams. Okay? And you can see that easily, for instance, on the example of the vacuum diagram. Consider just Z of 0. Okay? Remember, we have seen that Z of 0 is the sum over Z of 0 is the sum over all vacuum diagrams. Okay, so the vacuum diagrams are, it starts by 1 because there is you can normalize the vacuum energy so that it's 0, so that the exponential of 0 is 1. So you have.
To get that expansion, usually divided by the function of.
Here I am not dividing. I'm considering Z of 0 is just this functional interval. Okay? So here I'm not dividing. I divide by Z of 0 and I compute Green function. But this generating function are not defined through, I'm not normalizing the interval. So I will see how things depend on the measure, for instance, explicitly in this calculation. Okay? So if I do that, for instance, I get one, and then I get a diagram like that, and then I get a diagram like that, and then but I get also a diagram like that, etc. You see? Those are vacuum diagrams of the Feynman diagrams on the vacuum. Okay? The factor here comes here just because I'm computing an exponential, and there is a one term which gives one every time. With substance, you can consider that the empty set is a Feynman diagram with an amplitude one, if you like. That's one way to see that. Well, we'll see. It's slightly more complicated, but it's like that. Okay. And then when you take, and in fact, you see, if you compute what comes, if this term has a factor 1.18, and this diagram, if you compute it, at a factor 1/28, for instance, this diagram. And this diagram has a factor 1/48, but this diagram has a factor 1/28 is 1/80 squared times 1/2. So you see that you can view 1 + 1/8 plus 3. You can take these terms, okay, and write it as exponential of 1/8 or something like that. The first term of the expansion of the exponential of the amplitude associated to this diagram. And the point is that it works, in fact. And I will show you explicitly on some example why it works. But in fact, it's general. Taking the log of a sum of a contribution from some object usually gives you the sum of all connected objects. And that's a general phenomenon in combinatorics. It's not restricted to Feynman diagrams. Show this to a mathematician which is expert in combinatorics, and he say, oh, that's obvious. Euler knew that, because, for instance, Euler invented, in fact, generating functions, in fact. So it's an old object. Okay. But I will explain why this works on a simple example. And then I will define another object which is more subtle. So let me explain what it is. I will define something which is called the effective action. And that's something which is physical. This is a mathematical transformation. But now I want to define something which is called the effective potential. Okay. Which is the Legendre transform of W of G. Yes? Okay, so I will define an object in a four-ball way, and then I will compute it in the case of the 5-4 series so that you can see what it corresponds to. Okay. Using W of G, and I'm applying the formula, I may be interested in computing what is the expectation value of one phi operator in the 5-4 theory. Of course, in the 5-4 theory, this is zero by parity. But this is not zero if G is different from zero. So this is different from zero if G is different from zero. And it has to be, because when you take this one derivative, so this is, what is this? This is simply, we have seen, I consider this object at a point X. Okay? So this is a one-point Green function. And the one-point Green function, remember, it's simply h bar delta over delta g of x of z of divided by z of 0. That was the definition. Okay? If I don't put g equals 0 at the end, I can write this like that. So this is simply, remember, the functional derivative with respect to the source at the point x of w of g. Okay? But simply, I'm considering this when g is not equal to 0. And therefore, I don't put g equals 0 here. Okay? And this must not be equal to 0, because this must depend on g, so that if you take a second derivative with respect to the source, you get the two-point function, which is non-zero. So this object, with when g is different from 0, is a field. And I will call it, by definition, I call this object a field phi of x. And it's a functional. It is a functional of g of x. Okay, so this expectation value, so the functional derivative with respect to the source of this w function, I call it, it's a function, and I call it phi of x. Okay, so it's a function which is, and its value at each point is a functional of g. But it's a functional of g, not at the value of g, not at the point x. It's a functional of the source term everywhere. Because since you have correlation in your field, if you change the value of the, you are interested in the value of the field, the expectation value of the field at one point in space-time, and you change the source at another point, you are constructing the correlation function, the propagator, which is non-zero. So it means that this object, phi of x, depends on the source at the point y. So this is a function whose value at each point of space-time is a functional of the source considered as a function on space-time. So you see. So phi considered as a function is a function which is a functional of another function. So it's a bit complicated, but it's just a generalization to function of what are multidimensional integrals and multidimensional functions. So you have a function from one multidimensional space to another multidimensional space. And of course, here I am just dealing with function from one, the space of function g of x into the space of function phi of x. So I'm mapping a function on space-time and to another function of space-time. And this mapping is given by this object. You see? Yes?
I'm not sure, but when you differentiate w of j, you get, with respect to j of x, you get the derivative of z of j upstairs.
Yes.
But downstairs, you get z of j, yeah. Not z of 0.
Yeah. Ah, oh, yes. So let me rewrite this in the correct way. I compute this z of g. This is the derivative. I divide by z of g. Okay. Yeah. And this is delta over delta g of x of w of g. Okay. So once I define this field phi by this. By this definition, I take what mathematicians call a Legendre transform. So I am interested in what's happening to the physics of, of my quantum field theory when I don't fix the value of the source, but I fixed the value of the expectation value of the field. I'm interested in what I'm observing in the quantum field theory in general are expectation value of operators. And I am wondering, how can I study the theory when I vary some parameters, the coupling constant of the model? But what I am looking at is the expectation value of the field. Okay? So what I'm interested in, I want to consider, I want to make a change of variables, from g of y into phi of x. You see? So in order to do that, mathematicians know how to do that. They consider the Lejeune transform. So they consider a function which they define. So now I define another functional. And this functional is just g dot phi minus w of g. So with my notation, this is integral over before x, g of x, phi of x, minus w of g. You see? So this is the definition of the Lejeune transform. And this is called the effective potential. So this is the this is called the effective potential. And phi of x, which is defined by this definition by the functional derivative with respect to g of x of w of g, is called the background field. Take it as a definition. Okay? So what you see, I am starting from this functional of the source. I take its derivative, and this defines another field. I take this combination of the source, of the derivative of w and of w, and I, instead of considering it as a function of g, I make a change of variables, and I consider it as a function of phi. You see? And the question is, what is this? What does this generates? Does it generate some interesting object for quantum field theory? Yes?
The effect of action, isn't it? The effect of potential is what you get inside it when you start cruising.
Oh, effective potential or effective action, I'm sorry. One can either call it effective potential in the language of statistical mechanics and effective action in the language of quantum field theory. I'm sorry, I was written effective action, but I'm so used to the term of effective potential, so that's called either effective action. Yes?
So I've lost track of what gamma is.
Pardon?
I've lost track of what gamma is. Is gamma a functional of one?
Gamma is this function considered as a function of phi. This is a definition of gamma.
So if you picked a different j, you'd get a different gamma?
Pardon?
If you picked a different j, you would get a different gamma?
Of course, but you get, no, but you, if you pick a different j, you get a different gamma, but you get a different phi. Because phi is defined by this definition. So if I change g, if I change I get a different value of phi, and I consider gamma as a function of phi instead of a function of j. You see?
If phi were not written in terms of j originally,
pardon?
If phi weren't written in terms of j, but if it were just an arbitrary function, would we still be able to compute this?
Well, take this as a definition of the Lejeune transform.
Okay.
I have a function of some variable. The variable may be just one real variable. So it may be a vector. It's a function, that's it. Okay? If I have this function, I define the Lejeune transform as this function with phi being taken to be the derivative of w with respect to g. So the Lejeune transform is defined by those two equations. You see? This equation and this equation will give you the relation between g and phi.
Okay.
Okay. phi has to be the derivative of this W.
Okay.
Okay? Otherwise, it's a function of two variables, and I have not gained anything. I have complicated the problem. Okay? So, now let me compute what is this for. Now, well, so, at the moment, I've not said anything about what is the function Z. Now, I'm considering that the function Z of G is given by a functional integral of some corresponding to some action. And I am in the Euclidean time to simplify. Okay? So, in that case, what is 5x? 5x is given by, okay, and let me compute this. I am interested in computing this object. In order to do that, what I will be doing is computing this by saying that using what is called the saddle point approximation. Okay? I know that what is dominant in this functional integral is a point where this quantity, S of phi minus G phi, is maximum, is minimal. Okay? So let me look at what is the minimum of S of phi minus G phi. Okay? So in order to do that, I have to take the derivative, the functional derivative of phi. So I have to find a point in the space of function which I called phi c, okay, which is a solution of the equation delta s over delta phi of x minus g of x equals 0. And the solution of this equation defines the function phi c of y. You see? So you are looking, in fact, just you are solving the equation of motion, the Euler-Lagrange equation of your theory, but in your theory given by the original action plus the source term. Okay. And by seeing that, you see that phi, the solution, depends on g. It's a solution of the equation of motion with a second term, which is a source for your problem. You see? Okay. So this phi c of y is a functional of g of x. Okay? So now, once I have done that, I can change phi of x and write that phi of x is phi c of x plus some fluctuating part. So this is fixed. This is a function null of phi. Of G. Okay? And this is the part I integrate over phi tilde. Because instead of integrating over phi, I make a change of variables, I integrate over phi tilde. Okay, so how does this integration look like? Of course, I will expand S of phi minus G phi around the point. That's the right thing to do. So I can write this as S of phi c minus G phi c. Okay, so that's the first term. There is a term which is proportional to phi tilde, but it disappears because of this term. So there is a third term, which I will write in a very compact way, phi tilde, the second derivative of the action at the point phi c times phi tilde. Okay, and what does this mean for our theory? It means that what is s? What does this mean? This means simply that this is dx dy phi tilde of x, phi tilde of y, the second functional derivative with respect to phi, to point of the action of phi. Okay? So this compact notation means that I'm integrating over x and y phi tilde at point x, phi tilde at point y, times some kernel. This is a kernel. This is a function of x and y, and that the kernel, the integral kernel, kernel of the second derivative of phi c, of the action at the point phi c, which is an operator. So this is an operator. And its internal kernel is given by this functional derivative. OK? And we'll see what it is in the case of the phi 4 theory later. OK? So once you have done that, you can perform the integration, because then, and then you have, of course, higher order terms in terms of phi tilde. But now I am interested in doing a semi-classical approximation. So I'm doing a semi-classical expansion. So I am interested in what's happening where h bar is small, when h bar is small. So the quantum fluctuations are small, but I want to take into account the quantum fluctuation. Okay? So I can forget about these terms, because I have a 1 over h bar times the term of phi tilde. So you see that the fluctuation of phi tilde are of order square root of h bar. And therefore, this term is much smaller. The contribution of this term in this integral will be much smaller than this integral. So I am reduced to a Gaussian integration. And the integration over the phi tilde gives me simply the determinant of this operator to the power mod minus 1/2. So what I get simply is that I get that z of g is exponential of minus 1/2 of minus 1 over h bar times this term, s of phi c minus g times phi c. That's classical terms. And then I get the determinant of this operator at the power minus 1/2. Okay? I have just been using the fundamental results of Gaussian integration, that the integral of the exponential of some quadratic form is proportional to 1 over the square root of the determinant of this quadratic form. And here the quadratic form is the operator whose kernel is the second functional derivative of the action. OK? So I hope you remember what is the form of the definition of what is the effective action or the effective potential. And now, so therefore, I take the logarithm of that. I take the logarithm of that. And I multiply by h bar, and I get W of g. W of g is simply minus the action of phi c plus, there is a minus 1 h bar, so minus h bar over 2 is my definition, the logarithm of the determinant. Okay, and I will rewrite the logarithm of a determinant. The logarithm of a determinant, it's the logarithm of the product of the eigenvalue of an operator. So it's the sum of the logarithm of the eigenvalue. So I can rewrite this in a formal way as a trace of an operator, which is the logarithm of the second derivative of the action. Okay, and then I have some term of order h bar squared, which comes from the term I have neglected it. Okay? Pardon? The g term times phi term disappeared because of this equation. I am expanding around the saddle point of this. So there are no linear terms. Yes?
The expression of C of J is just in the last line of the work.
Pardon?
In the last line of the board, you have Z of J equal exponential of something that contains J yes. part of C, and then it disappears when you take it to
wrong. No, but here I have G times 5.
Yes.
So when
I understand where the J 5 of C comes from, but I don't understand why it would disappear in W of J.
In the transition function, you have J 5 classical. And then you took the log?
No. But yeah. That's a fact. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. That's the reason. Yeah, you are. Same as in chat. Sorry. Yes. Okay. So, once we have that. Okay, so we have that. And we have the relation between phi classical and G, which is given by this. Okay? So I get that. I will rewrite this in a very compact way. This equation, I rewrite it as saying that the derivative of S is equal to G. Okay? So now, what is the... So I know the relation between G and S. So now, from that, I can compute what is phi. Phi is the derivative of W divided by G. Okay? Then, what is it? In this sense, you have two terms. You have a derivative with respect to G. You have a G which is explicit here. And you have but you must remember the fact that phi c depends on g through this equation. So you have two terms. You have phi c plus something, which is minus the derivative of phi c with respect to g. Okay, because phi c depends explicitly of xi in a way which I don't know. So I have to take into account how this term depends on phi c and multiply by the derivative. But what is the derivative of when I take the derivative of this? So times the derivative of this. Pardon? There is no minus, there is a plus. You are right. Of g phi c minus s of phi c. Okay, so that's the expression, a very compact expression for what is the derivative of W with respect to G. But what is this term? This is G minus S prime of phi C, which disappears. So this is zero because of this equation. Okay? So I get that this is phi C. And then I may have all the terms coming from this term that I neglected. But I know that phi is equal to phi c up to order h bar squared. So because, oh, okay? So, then. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I may have term of order h bar, but these are term of order 1. But so they may be other terms, but I don't need to know that because I have this. So that's enough. Okay? So now, I want to invert the equation. I want to know how g depends on how g depends on phi. So I want to invert this equation. You see? I have a relation between G and phi C, and I have I have a relation between the background field and the point. So I just will invert this. I can invert this by saying that G is equal to minus delta of the derivative of the action, so phi prime of phi c. Okay? But I know that phi c is equal to phi up to term of order h bar, so I can rewrite this as, I'm sorry, s prime one time. Yes, it's minus s prime of phi c, so I can rewrite this as minus s prime of the background field plus term of order h bar. Okay? You see? Because I know that phi is approximately equal to phi c. Good? Okay? And now I can compute the, so I have this result, phi equals phi c up to order h bar, and I have this result, which gives me the relation between g, the source term, and the background term. No, there is a plus. Oh, I'm sorry. So that's because in my notes I have I made calculation in the real time, and there are signs which are different. So you're right.
And yeah. In all this, we're ignoring the trace term?
Pardon?
In all this, we're ignoring the trace?
No, no. Here I'm ignoring the trace. I'm just looking at the relation between phi and g. And now I will plug it here. You see? And now I am computing gamma of phi. Remember, gamma of phi is g phi minus w of g. Okay? Now I express g as a function of phi. I get s prime of phi times phi. Now I get here g. And I get w, so I get minus s prime of phi, phi c. Then I get minus s of phi c, but I know that phi c is equal to phi, so I can replace this by phi, so I can replace this by phi. And there is a plus because I have a minus plus, I have a minus, oh yes, I have a minus, I have a plus here. And then I have this h bar over 2, trace logarithm of the derivative, second derivative of the action at phi c, but I can replace phi c by phi. So I can replace this by trace logarithm of of the second derivative of s at the point phi. Okay? So once I've done that, I have a very compact result because you see that those two terms disappear because phi is equal to, so this term disappears. And what I get is a result which is very general, which is that the effective action is proportional to S of phi is equal, I'm sorry, that the effective action considered as a function of the background field, let me, is the action, that's the original classical action of the theory, plus h bar over 2 trace of the logarithm of a differential, so the trace of a differential operator, this operator, is the logarithm of the operator, the second derivative of the action taken at phi. And then I have term of order h bar squared. Okay? Yes?
Yeah, my question was that how could we just cancel those two terms? Because phi is equal to phi c plus something of order h bar you wrote over there.
Yes, but in fact this term, it's of order h squared, so this is of order h squared. I'm sorry. So in fact, this is an identity up to order h squared. And therefore, in fact, there are terms which they are of order h squared and not of order h. Let's check that carefully. But I was a bit quick. But if you do the things carefully, you check that the term of order h bar disappear, and the terms which are remaining as r of order h bar squared.
But yes? In the line right above, when you computed phi, and you took the derivatives of w, but yeah. You didn't take the derivative of the trace term, and that term was...
No, but that's because I could neglect that order.
But the trace term is order h, and you
yes, but it h yes, but it disappears, yeah.
Okay.
I thought it was obvious in the way I was presented, but if it's not obvious, we can discuss that later.
Okay.
But it's full, and it's very easy. So once you have done that, you end up with this formula, which is a nice formula, because it's true for any kind of action. You see? That's true for any action, and in fact, any quantum field theory, as long as you have only bosonic field. So it's a formula which will be true for scalar field, for gauge field, etc. It will be true for quantum gravity. Quantum gravity makes sense. It's a formula I have not used. I'm just using the fact that I have some field, but I have not specified whether it was a scalar field or whether it was a multi-component field. I was considering a scalar field, but here I didn't vote that it was depending on the position of point. In fact, it's a very, very general solution. You see?
And where did the bosonic part come in?
Oh, it came because I just, at some point, computed. I have to compute the functional integral over the fluctuating part of the bosonic field of exponential of minus 1/2 phi times. The phi has to be bosons in order for this to be determinant of the problem. I'm doing a Gaussian integral over real values. Okay? And we'll see tomorrow that for bosons, you can define a functional integral over bosons, but the fields are anti-commuting numbers. And instead of being a determinant to the power of minus 1/2, it's a determinant to the power of 1. And therefore, instead of adding a plus 1/2, you get a minus trace of the value. Yes?
Are you neglecting the factors of pi that comes with the Gaussian integral or the Hermitian?
No, I am not neglecting them. They are here, but they are just a constant. You see? So they are somewhere in the definition of the log. They are just a constant. They do not depend on phi. So they are hidden in the definition of what is the trace and what is the log. But they are constant, so they do not depend on phi. So they just renormalize the vacuum energy, as usual with those constant terms. So they are hidden. I have just met. Okay, so now I have, let me give you 5 minutes. Let us apply this very, very general formula to the lambda phi to the 4 interacting theory. What is S? S of phi is, I write it like that, d4x. So I will write it like, I am in the Euclidean regime. So this is... plus g over 4 phi to the 4. This is the action for the phi 4 theory in Euclidean time. Okay? So what is the second derivative of phi? The second derivative of phi, okay, it's a kernel it's a differential operator. So it's kernel. We already computed it. What is it? It is you take the second derivative of this object with respect to phi. What do you get? You get the kernel operator or minus this. So this, if you take a derivative with phi, two derivatives with phi, you get this operator. And if you take two derivatives with respect to phi of this, you get, of course, plus g over 2 phi squared. Okay? So this is an operator whose integral kernel is the integral kernel of this operator. There is a minus the Laplacian operator plus m squared times the identity operator plus an operator which is non-trivial because it's g divided by 2 times the multiplication by the field itself squared. So this operator depends on phi. But there is a factor g here. You see? So now, here I get the original action of the model. So this effective action, if there are no quantum effects, if h bar is equal to 0, you recover the original action of the model. And that's the contribution of the quantum fluctuation, the modification by the quantum fluctuation to the dynamics of the model. Okay? Now let us write this. What is log? So this operator, this is an operator. So I can write it in a simple way. I will write it as minus times 1 plus g over 2 minus 1 times phi squared. Okay? I'm allowed to do that. Okay? And then I expand the log. What is the log of this object? Phi. This is the log of minus Laplacian plus m squared plus the log of this operator. This operator is the logarithm of 1 plus something which is small when the Kupik constant is small. You see? So I will expand the log using the formula that the log of 1 plus x is minus x plus x over 2 plus x squared over 2, etc. So I get, no, it's x minus x over 2, so I get plus g over 2 times this operator. And what is this operator? You recognize this operator? This is the propagator of the free field. Okay? So I will write this in a compact way, g naught times phi squared, where g naught is the propagator of the free field. Okay? So this is g naught phi squared minus g squared over 4. Oh, and no, there is an 8 here, etc. Phi, g naught phi to the 4, g naught phi squared, g naught phi squared, and then plus g cube over 3 times times 1 over 8, g naught phi squared, g naught phi squared, g naught phi squared, etc. Okay? I'm expanding the log. Now I take the trace. What does it mean to take the trace? I'm almost finished. I take the trace, and I want to compute this term, h bar over 2, trace log of. Okay, I take the trace. So I first get h bar over 2 trace log of minus Laplacian plus m squared. That's the vacuum energy, in fact, of the free field. This is the vacuum energy of the free field. And then I get correction. Okay? The first correction is g over 2 times. So I get h bar over 4. Yes, times the trace of g naught phi squared. What does it mean to take the trace of g naught phi squared? It's take, it means to take the integral of x, g naught of x, x minus x, phi squared of x. What does it mean to take the trace of this object? It means to take h bar over 2 times 1 over 2 times, there is a minus sign, times g over 2 squared, times integral over x, integral over y of g naught of x minus y, so that's the first propagator, phi squared of y, that's the phi which is here, Then I take a propagator G naught between Y and the second point here, but I take the trace, so this second point is X times phi squared of X. You see? What is this, the third term? H bar over 2 times 1 over 3rd, G over 2 to the power 3, integral over dx dy dz, G naught of X minus Y, phi squared of Y, G naught of Y minus Z, phi squared of Z, G naught of Z minus X, because I'm taking the trace, phi squared of X, et cetera, and I continue. Okay? Now, represent this object in terms of Feynman diagrams. Because this is a propagator, and there is a phi squared here.
There should be a G over 2 in that term.
Pardon?
There should be a G over 2 in front of that term.
There is a G over 2 times 3.
No, the one before me.
Yes. Sorry. So this is an error. Yes. So, okay. So what is this term in terms of Feynman diagrams? This is a Feynman diagram closed onto itself, a propagator closed onto itself. So I can rewrite this as this diagram. And here I have made a, I have added a phi and a phi, because I have phi squared. What is this diagram? I have, and this is a point X. You see the point X. What is this diagram? I have one propagator between two points. I have the same propagator between the two points. And at the point X, I have a phi and I have a phi. At the point Y, I have a phi and a, I have a phi. You see? So I can represent this term by two propagators connected to two different points. At each point, I associate two phi. One phi here, two phi here, two phi here. What is this term? This term is, I have now three propagators at three different points. So I can write this as a diagram in the shape of a triangle. You see, this is a point X, this is a point Y, this is a point Z. Here I have two phi. Here I have two phi. Here I have two phi. You see? So, and then it's not difficult to guess what is the following. The next term will be something like that, because I have a trace of four propagators. The next term will be a with five propagators, so it will be a pentagon. Five. Okay, and finally, this term, since here I have a propagator with two phi, here I have two propagators with four phi, here I have three propagators with three phi, I would like, it's just a picture, to rewrite this term as a propagator with no beginning and no end, so it's just a line. So this is just a way to represent this object. It's just a picture, a new Feynman diagram. The Feynman diagram represents the energy of the vacuum of the theory. I represent it by a circle. Okay. So basically, this is what. So what is gamma of phi? Gamma of phi is the action plus the sum of this diagram at order 2. Okay. So I get this term represent all possible one loop diagram of the theory, but not all loop diagram. So those are the diagram of the 5-4 theory where you are removed the external legs. So they are called amputated Feynman diagrams, because this is not a Feynman diagram of 5-4 theory. The Feynman diagram of the 5-4 theory is this diagram, Z1, Z2, X. The Feynman diagram I obtained here is a Feynman diagram where I have removed those two lines. This Feynman diagram is not a Feynman diagram of the 5-4 theory. A Feynman diagram of the 5-4 theory would be a diagram like that. And the corresponding diagram you count here is the diagram where you cut those lines. So those are called amputated Feynman diagrams. You see? So I remove the propagator, the external propagator. See? And one more thing, which is almost obvious here, but it's not obvious, as it were. So those diagrams are what is called one line irreducible. Because you see here that I am recovering just, I do not recover at that order. At that order, it's not possible, but this is a diagram which is not irreducible because you can cut this line. You see? A diagram like that is not irreducible because I can cut this line. And in fact, at one loop, you cannot see that very easily. But you can try to compute the next diagram of the effective action. The calculation is much more complicated, but the calculation can be done. And you can check that, in fact, the effective actions give you the sum over all possible Feynman diagram of the theory, where you have amputated the external legs, and where those diagrams are irreducible. So for instance, and let me end up with this statement. If you are interested, for instance, in computing for a theory which has a phi 3 interaction term instead of a phi 4 interaction term, you can play the same game. Simply, instead of having diagram like that, you will have diagram like diagram like that, etc. Diagram like that, which are irreducible. So that's at order h bar, and at order h bar squared, you discover that you may have this diagram with some line here. Amputated diagram like that, but you don't have this diagram. The diagram like that is a diagram which appears at order 2 with the amputated line here. But this diagram is not an irreducible diagram, and therefore this diagram is not present in the effective action from the rule of calculation. So you get only this diagram in phi cube theory, for instance, at 2 loop. You see? Okay. And that's a general feature. So one advantage of dealing with the effective action is that you reduce enormously the number of diagrams you have to compute. And once you have computed the effective action, you know a lot of things about the theory. So it's a subject which is very important both for the understanding of quantum theory and for actual calculation.
You can use the effective action in the same way that you use the normal action?
In some sense, the effective action is the action which allows you to treat a quantum theory like a classical theory. But it's a very complicated, it's a complicated theory. But for instance, imagine that you are fine in the, let us consider a phi cube theory, okay? And you are interested in computing interaction between three particles, with three particles entering and three particles out, and you want to compute some asymmetric element. You compute it from some with rules, Feynman rules, so you have some Feynman diagrams. And in general, you may have it can be a very complicated object. But there's something you can say about that. You can say that, for instance, you have a diagram like that, okay? You see? And you may have, this is one diagram, and here you have very complicated, you have complicated diagram, but they are irreducible, okay? You can always decompose a Feynman diagram which is connected in terms of irreducible parts which are connected by lines. That's almost trivial if you start to draw it. For example, this diagram, you know, It's a connected diagram, and it's, there is one irreducible part here, one irreducible part here, which are connected by lines. So I can say that this diagram, it is this times the big block, times this, times the big block, times this. Okay? Here I am doing the same thing. So those are the irreducible diagrams. They are given by the effective action. And once you know the effective action, you can reconstruct some quantum amplitudes out of three diagrams whose vertices are the irreducible diagrams given by the effective action. You see? So if you know the effective action, you can reconstruct the quantum theory, treating it as a classical theory, but with a very, very complicated interaction term which is given by the effective action. Because the three diagrams correspond to treating the theory at the classical level. You have no loops, so you have no intermediate state, quantum intermediate state. So in fact, the theory at the level of three diagrams is still a classical theory. You see? I have to stop here, but you see why it's very useful to deal with such quantities, and such quantities are generated. You can construct them by generating functional, and it's often much easier to compute the generating functional from scratch. Because, for instance, the calculation I've been doing explicitly, I've been doing a calculation where I computed an infinite number of Feynman diagrams. You see. So doing this calculation just at the level using the Vick theorem would have been awful, because I would have to do for these diagrams and this one, this one, this one, and then I would have to start to sing and to say, ha ha, the other one should be the same. Yes?
If you did something to the power of h bar squared,
yes,
that would give us the two loops?
Yes, yes. And in fact, there is something I wanted to say, which is very important. I have no way to prove. It is that when you have here, you have a term of order h, okay, is given by the diagrams with k loops. And you can do that just by counting how many h you must have and how many g's you must have. So, but that's a very general rule. So one often speaks about the loop expansion in quantity theory, instead of speaking about the perturbative expansion in the Cooking constant or of a semi-classical expansion in terms of the Planck constant, because that's the same. Perturbing in terms of Cooking constant, doing a semi-classical expansion assuming that h bar is small and expands over h bar, or just counting how many loops you have in your diagram is always the same. But I have no time to prove that. Thank you.
So when you break, stuff and some strike, thanks for the picture.